Reception number 8736 for room number 42.
You were talking about the high level of inter-service cooperation on Cyprus.
Yes.
What was the RAF involved with in particular?
Well, they were caught involved with our own security, as there was the air base at Akateri, which was one of the main British air bases in the Mediterranean and covering for the Middle East generally. But they also, later on, became involved in the use of helicopters. And that was, I have always been very enthusiastic about the use of helicopters for, first of all, for My interest in them started in Malaya, where we introduced them for casualty evacuation from the jungle, and then went on from there to use them for reconnaissance, communications, and eventually supply. And so I was anxious to get them into use in Cyprus, because they were the one way of introducing the element of surprise into the operations against the terrorists. And so we built up, the RAF provided a squadron of helicopters which were extensively used in anti-terrorist operations. And apart from their own security, was the way in which they cooperated. And of course the Navy were involved in what I call the Cyprus Patrol, because one of the most important things to do right away from the start was to insulate the island from outside support, from both in terms of personnel and in terms of arms, ammunition, and explosives, because one of the first things that had happened before I went there was that a ship from Greece, a small craft, arrived with a load of arms and ammunition. And that process, the attempts to do that were continuing, and also, of course, leaders and trainers coming in that way from the mainland. And so the Cyprus Patrol, which was frigates patrolling around the coast of the island and stopping any incoming shipping that was carrying arms, ammunition, or terrorist leaders, had to be very, very efficient indeed. So much so that I and my chief of staff, George Baker, took a particular interest in this. And eventually it led to my asking Mountbatten, who was Sea Lord at that time, to change the Admiral in charge. It's not something you'd like to do, but that's what we did, and that was done. And he sent out a chap called Tony Myers, who had won the VC in the war, who was excellent. And that, the Cyprus Patrol, the naval patrol, was to stop the infiltration of arms, ammunition, and personnel, supporters of the OCA, and customs, of course, were also involved in that, because there was smuggling of arms and ammunition. So in order to insulate the island from outside support and intervention, both those two things, the Cyprus Patrol, the Royal Navy, and the customs officials, were essential to have them rarely secure, and that took a little time to do.
When do you think that was under control? When would you say? You arrived late 1955, didn't you?
Well, I should think it took the best part of a year I think, it gradually, steadily improved, of course, as time went on. But I should think it wasn't as effective as it should have been, I don't think, for about a year, I would guess. But I wouldn't like to be categorical about that. It was, of course, in Ulster, isn't it? Because it's impossible, physically impossible, it seems, to stop movements of terrorists with arms and ammunition from the Republic into Ulster.
Talking about helicopters, you were mentioning the extensive use of them with the RAF.
Yes.
Did you have your own helicopter?
Yes. There was one. There was always one provided at my disposal, and I used it a great deal, of course, for getting around.
Where would that have landed for your use?
It landed at the Government House.
You had a heliport there, did you?
Well, you don't need very much room. At the back of the house, there was a yard. There was sort of yard space where the staff quarters were, which is big enough for a helicopter to land and take off. Doesn't need very much room. And they were very expert, the RAF pilots there, about their helicopters. The chap who used to fly me around, I always used to say, could land on the sixpenny bit and take off. I mean, if he found wanted to get somewhere up in the mountains, he'd find a place where there was perhaps a few square yards of open space and land there. No, they were brilliant. And they were extremely valuable.
Yes, a look of glee comes on your face when you talk of helicopters. This is an aspect you obviously enjoyed, I would think.
Well, I think, you see, ever since I was at Southern Command in 47, 48, I began to think in terms of the use of helicopters in the Army for reconnaissance and command and communications. And I ran an exercise down in Devon. It must have been, I suppose, about 47, I took over 47, might have been 48, I suppose, and we wrote a full report about it. And that, I think, got pigeonholed in the War Office and nothing was done about it. And it took a long time, and it wasn't until the Americans really increased or extended the use of helicopters in land operations in Vietnam. But we used them. We began to use them in Malaya for casualty evacuation. We extended that to using them for communication, reconnaissance and supply, and then eventually for the movement of troops. And it took some time to get the authorities and that be, powers that be, to provide the resources that were needed to do that in Cyprus. But once we did, we were able to reintroduce the element of surprise into the anti-terrorist operations. Previously, the big sweeps across the mountains and forests and so on, the approach had to be by their long by lorry or on foot, and the terrorist gangs got ample warning of the arrival of the security forces.
Talking of the experience in Malaya, did you draw on that extensively for Cyprus?
Oh, yeah, much so. You see, although the conditions and situations and the problems were different in many ways, there were a good deal of comparability. And you compare the forests of Cyprus with the jungles of Malaya. But the great, the important conclusion from my experience in Malaya that I was applied to Cyprus was the absolutely essential need for the various elements concerned with anti-terrorist operations to work together, to be integrated, That is to say, the civil administration, the police, and the armed forces. And we developed in Malaya a system of what you might call tripartite direction of the three elements. And that was the outstanding lesson, in my mind, of the anti-terrorist campaign in Malaya. That was built on and developed by General Templer when he went out there extended and became a complete reality. And that we applied in Cyprus. And each district was had a district commissioner who was a civil authority, then there was the senior soldier, a brigadier or whatever, and the senior policeman. And those three worked together to plan and carry out anti-terrorist operations. And that is, in my view, is an absolute essential. So that was something from Malaya I picked up from Malaya and implanted in the anti-terrorist operations in Cyprus.
When you had assessed the situation and determined your policy, did you attempt to propagate this to the people? You know, for instance, were you able to use a broadcasting system to speak to
yes.
the Cypriots?
Yes, oh yes, of course. I made a periodical. Well, I did two things, really. First of all, I had periodical and fairly regular meetings of what I call the security committee. So those are the three: the district commissioner, the senior soldier, and the policeman, at my headquarters, and explained to them the situation and the policy, and particularly, of course, any changes in policy and any developments that were necessary, so that they knew exactly what I was thinking and what my plans and policies were. And also I did less frequent but periodical broadcasts to the people of Cyprus, trying to explain to them why we were doing what we were doing in the way of anti-terrorist operations and the political policy of the British government.
What language did you
use? In English, always in English.
Would they have understood English?
Oh yes, I think so. Oh yes.
The great majority of
Cypriots. The great majority would understand English, or it's not be translated for them. Oh yes. And my wife did broadcast too, of course, on the welfare side. I think I've got some of the records now, if you would like to hear them sometime. The trouble is, I don't think you can put them on an ordinary record player now. They're the large size records and things about that way. I know my wife wanted to have them run for somebody a few years ago, and we found we couldn't get them onto our record player. It was an old-fashioned gramophone. Might be of interest, I don't know.
So this was quite a regular thing, was it, your broadcast?
Well,
to
I suppose. In any change in the situation or development.
Did you have an information officer, just dealing with publicity?
I had a foreign office official dealing with public relations, yes.
Who was he?
Oh, what was he? The Larry Darrells, he was, I found him there when I went out there. I found him there, he was in the public relations setup that I found there. And he was—he did a lot of pamphleteering, writing of pamphlets about various aspects of the Cyprus problem, which were circulated. Yes, he was there. And then he, I don't know for what reason, he finished his time there and left. And then I had this, I can't remember the name of the Foreign Office official who came out and took over public relations, but he was quite, well, he was a very competent chap, and I think had a successful career in the Foreign Office.
Was that Leslie Glass?
Leslie Glass, that's right. You're right, yes, it's Leslie Glass.
Was that useful for you to have these people?
Oh, yes, it was essential. It was essential, particularly, you see, as you had, it was an area of great interest to the press and the media. And you're always having visiting correspondents. And I used to make a point of getting any new correspondent come up in the evening and have a drink, and I'd spend an hour or more explaining my view of the situation and my policies to it, and being as frank as I possibly could within the bounds of needs of security. And I found that paid off, very much so. I don't think I don't ever relax being what I call let down by anybody to whom I've been well talked in confidence. And I think only one occasion did that happen. But it's an essential feature of any job of that kind.
What was the occasion when you were let down? Can you remember what happened then?
Well, I'd rather not talk about it. Right? Mm. Well, at one time it happened that a British soldier disappeared. And the OCA claimed that he was a deserter. We didn't believe it. And the Daily Express correspondent in Cyprus refused to carry this story. And he refused to report to his office in London about it. And he was sacked. And so I wrote to Beaverbrook and said how he conducted his affairs was no business of mine, but I thought that he ought to know that this correspondent, in my judgment, had rightly refused to carry the popular report this chap was a deserter, because we were certain it wasn't true. And so I was then summoned or asked to go and see Beaverbrook the next time I was in London. So I went along to his flat and talked to him. And he explained, he said, well, if you run a newspaper, you've got to carry all the stories that are going around. And this chap wasn't prepared to report this, although the official view was that it was incorrect. I think he was wrong, so he was dismissed. I think the Daily Express were wrong. But that was a rather an interesting incident, so to speak, over this business of public relations.
There was a paper, I believe, called The Times of Cyprus.
Yes, so
which was started by Charles Foley.
Charles Foley was the editor.
What did you have any?
Yes, I had a lot of encounters with him, because I think that he and his paper misreported and misrepresented things, and they took him to task over it. And then he came back. He was then he went to the Daily Express, I think. I think he went to the Express. No, he was there were. the Times of Cyprus, there were two Cyprus papers printed in English. The Times of Cyprus was one with Charles Foley as editor, and the Cyprus Times, Cyprus Times, I think it was called, the other. And the Times of Cyprus Isaac was subsidized. I've no proof of this, but I think it was subsidized by the Archbishop and his organization. But they were certainly pro-Greek, very, very strongly Greek partisan in their reporting. And this I took exception to and told Charles Foley accordingly. Partisan. But then you see, the Greeks are partisan in many ways. Well, they are. They're naturally. They're tremendous nationalists, the Greeks, and maybe rightly so. I believe, and I may be wrong, but I believe that the average Greek attitude to us, the British, is this. They claim that when we, the British, came down out of our trees and washed off, took off our world, that we started to study the ancient Greek philosophers. And British culture, British political philosophy, is based on the writings of the ancient Greek philosophers. Therefore, the present-day Greeks, and particularly the Greeks in Cyprus, claim that we, the British, owe everything to them and to their forebears. And for that reason, we ought to give them everything they ask for. And when we do, they love us, and when we don't, they hate us. And that is what I call the Greek, and particularly the Greeks in Cyprus, love-hate complex towards the British. That is my explanation, but I may be exaggerating.
And you think Foley was sympathetic towards that?
And because we wouldn't give them self-determination, they supported the yoke.
Did you find that the Times of Cyprus, you know, you mentioned the bias you perceived in this paper, did it cause a lot of mischief because it was ostensibly an English paper or a paper, you know, published in the English language?
Yes, of course. But I think, you know, it's always very difficult to assess what the extent of the influence of a newspaper of that kind is. I think with the media, from a military, looking at it from a soldier's point of view, I think it's very difficult to assess in any degree of accuracy the extent of that sort of thing on military operations. I think take for example the Falklands. The extent of misreporting or misrepresentation, the effect on the actual conduct of military operations, I don't know to what extent it was. And I think it's extremely difficult to assess. Generally speaking, I am very much against any form of suppression of the press and the media in reporting on military operations. I think one has to rely on their integrity, which is a very doubtful pillar on which to rely, and on their knowledge. And mostly, they're not very knowledgeable about military operations or military techniques or attitudes. I mean, occasionally you get them in the First World, in the Second World War, for example. Allen, what was his name? I knew him very well. There were one or two really good war correspondents who reported, actually understood things. But by and large, the average reporter, even when accredited to command headquarters, doesn't really know very much about it. And in Cyprus, of course, we took as much pains as we possibly could to keep them properly informed. But for a great deal, part of the time, and for a great many of them, their reports are written in the bar of the Leisure Palace Hotel. They don't inspire me with a great deal of confidence.
Did you have any powers towards the press?
Oh, I had all the powers in the world, yes. You could impose censorship, you could restrict their movement. Under emergency regulations, oh yes, you could do that.
Did you ever feel that you had to do that?
Well, I had to do a certain amount of it, yes. And we also went in for jamming the broadcasts from Greece and from Athens. But again, looking back on it all, I am very doubtful to what extent these things really had a powerful influence on the conduct or success or otherwise military operations. And I think myself that it's always best to tell the press and the media all you can within the bounds of security and keep them informed so that they don't make completely reports out of ignorance or lack of education or understanding. And that again is difficult. It applies particularly, I think, when strong partisan factors are applicable. I mean, for example, in Cyprus, the average reporter or journalist or editor in the English press would have looked upon the Greeks as educated, civilized, sophisticated people, and the Turks as crude and rough, uncouth people, and rather brutal. And that undoubtedly affected their representations, their reporting. But, and again, the same applied to intellectuals in this country, many of whom learned Greek at school and were tremendous admirers of the ancient Greek philosophers and Greek tragedies and so on. And this does influence your position, your views. And one of the big disadvantages, I think, with which I was faced in Cyprus was that there was no strong body of opinion in this country which was thought that the British government was right in its policies towards Cyprus, and particularly towards the Greek people.